Well, I'll gradually tell you what both of these things are in case you didn't know. But let me just say at the beginning that the common link between them is conformal field theory. Which, by definition, is the mathematically correct part of string theory. And so, of course, that contains some operator algebras. Well, there are two main questions that have arisen in this area, and the first is automorphic representations of compact Lie groups. And the second is a geometric interpretation of confusion, which, sorry about the pun, thank God the talk isn't being given in French or it wouldn't make any sense. And this is a joint project with something that Vaughan Jones is doing. And this is also related to a more general problem of understanding so-called boundary conformal field theory, or another aspect of that is some open string theory. There are plenty of mathematical problems related here. This is a particular case of that. Well, let me start by some revision. This is the microchip that I always have the dream will be in people's heads. It wasn't, unfortunately, in mine. It is a microchip. When Vaughan and I started working on conformal field theory, I gave a lecture in the Collège de France in Paris, and Alain got up and said, all that you need to know is the CAR algebra on this stamp. And I think this was before microchips were popular, so in those days you'd stick the Alencon stamp to you and know everything about the canonical anti-commutation relations. Now I dream of a microchip, because that'd be quite quicker. Anyway, so let's look at fermions and projective representations. So all of this should be very well known, so I apologize for that. So let H be a real or complex inner product space with an orthonormal basis, En, and then define operators on the exterior algebra of H. Just by these wedge products, and then they satisfy the CAR relations, as you just clear the anti-commute, and then if you look at the adjoints, which are just interior multiplication, you'll find this relation, and then you can extend linearly to operators AF for any F in H, and then you'll have analogues of these relations, a natural extension. Okay, and these are called the canonical. That they're the stamp relations, the canonical anti-commutation relations, and they are also called fermions, as we'll see when we give a kind of more physicsy way of seeing them.
Linearly, it's obvious if H is real. What if H is complex?
Sorry?
I mean, linear extension is obvious when H is real, but when H is complex, then...
It's also not very hard. because I mean you just satisfy.
I mean, usually f is anti-linear with respect.
No. It's linear with respect to.
No, he's complaining that you put it anti-linear with respect to g.
This is linear in f and anti-linear in g. I'm not using the physics notation for the inner product. I'm sorry, but things happen. So for me, linear here, anti-linear there. Otherwise, just apply the usual involutory automorphism of the complex numbers, lambda goes to lambda bar, to change your universe. Okay, well, now if you define these operators, now you get something which is only real linear. So this is a real fermion. And the only relation that you have here uses the real part of the inner product. And if you have a complex inner product space, then you can actually go back and define A of F . Now, it's very easy to see that the A of Fs, the A of F and A of F stars, act irreducibly. This is sometimes called the complex wave representation, but if H, and so the C of Fs act irreducibly if H is complex. But it's not true if H is real. And let me just take it as R2N is real. And actually, going back in this picture, well, even in this case, lambda of H becomes an algebra using the C of Fs. And for example, you can define the Clifford multiplication of V and W will be V wedge W plus the inner product of W. And if you use take a complex structure, by identifying it with Cn, compatibly with the real parts of the inner products, then just reading back here, you will immediately see that the Clifford algebra acts irreducibly on S, which is lambda of Cn, regarded as a complex space. And that's an irreducible representation. So in any case, it's always isomorphic to this end of S. And here, this has a natural gradation into even and odd parts. Okay. Well, now, in infinite dimensions, we can do something a little bit more interesting, going back to Dirac, and we'll take vectors like this, or in general EI1, EI2, wedge, so on, which have the same tail, eventually. And then you equally well get the Clifford the AFs act on here. Same relations, irreducibly. now, this, if I let, take the linear span of E0, E1, and so on, and let P be the projection, then actually, if I evaluate a typical element of the Clifford algebra, then, first of all, this only gives a non-zero answer if n is equal to n, and then I just get this determinant. And that tells me that the representation actually only depends on the projection. So the representation depends only on P. So then I could take a Q, another projection, and ask what happens with the same construction. Another Q gives a unitarily, this is still part of the microchip, by the way, a unitarily equivalent representation, and then you just do the trick. Well, you have to kind of just play around with the two vectors for orthonormal bases, and that's if, and you find out that this is true if and only if the difference of the two is Hilbert-Schmidt. So remember that a matrix is Hilbert-Schmidt, its norm is just, it's the easiest norm of a matrix you can write down. Right, so that's got to be finite. And then you can, or you also, you see that if you have a unitary U in H, then you can get an automorphism of the Clifford algebra relations just by applying the unitary, because the relations depend only on the inner product. Applying a unitary won't change that, and so you can get another representation. It's an automorphism. And you say that U is quantized if and only if there exists a U, and this big space is called F for Fock, although this construction is due to Dirac, I believe, called the Dirac C, Fock space. So you want a unitary U on Fock space such that U AF U star implements the little U. Well, this is another this will give another representation anyway, because I've applied an automorphism. And from this formula, you see that it corresponds to the projection, this representation corresponds to the projection U star PU, and so U is implemented if and only if the commutator of U and P is Hilbert-Schmidt. And the U is unique up to a phase. By irreducibility, Schur's lemma. And so you get a projective, that's what this is, projective representation of quantized unitaries. So you get a projective representation. I could write this space as things that almost commute with P like this. Okay. Now, in finite dimensions, you can just slightly generalize this. I took complex linear things, finite dimensions. You just have that U, any U in SOV is implemented, and the projective representation then gives you a double cover of SOV, and this sits inside the Clifford algebra of V. And so the unitary here will just satisfy UCF U star CU of UF. So it's exactly the same picture. And in finite dimensions, a possible choice of plus or minus one, which is more complicated in infinite dimensions. So the infinite dimensional example, and this is where conformal field theory has already started with this example, because this is the first, you start with a fermionic string, and this is more or less what you'd be doing. Well, you take H to be L2 functions on the circle, and I'll take N copies there, just because that's sort of easier, and then the projection of H onto the Hardy space. So these are the functions on the circle with only non-negative Fourier contributions, and this is the Hardy space projection. I have to write that because I'm in Cambridge. But I will not be writing Littlewood, alas. And then we define, we'll take G to be SUN or any simply connected simple subgroup. Actually here SU2 will be ideal. And then the loop group of G is maps from S1 to G such that, well, I take them to be continuous and the derivative piecewise continuous. It just makes things easier. And this has an automorphism group, just the orientation preserving diffeomorphisms of the circle. So you really are talking about a semi-direct product. And this is quantized. This is quantized. So each element of this group approximately commutes with the Hardy space projection. And in the case of the loop group, that's just the fact that you have a multiplication by a function and this is smooth, then this is Hilbert-Schmidt. In fact, it's even trace class. So this is a kind of Toeplitz estimate. And as we've seen 2 weeks ago, this is sort of half of the starting point of cyclic cohomology. But it's very important to have L2, anything else won't work, alas, for quantization, which makes this theory really not work in higher dimension. That's why conformal field theory, why it is confined to dimension S, one dimensions, or 1+1 dimensions. Alas, nobody's been able to do anything further. Well, this representation of LG is positive energy. So although it's infinite dimensional, it's quite nice because restricted to the rotation group, well, you can just, you know, you've got an action of the circle group, so you can write the whole Fock space as eigenspaces of, so if a vector is in here, rotation by theta on psi is e to the in theta psi. These are eigenspaces for rotations. And here what happens is only positive things appear, and that was part of Dirac's game, to make sure the energy was positive. R theta is usually, by physicists, it's written as e to the I L naught theta. That's the infinitesimal generator, and this is the thing that should be positive. And each of these is finite dimensional. And then we're really in a very algebraic world in some sense, because then we can start doing Katz-Moody algebras and everything becomes kind of finitistic. This is still all contained in the CAR stamp. Any positive energy representation breaks up is a direct sum of irreducible positive energy representations. And for example, for SU2, you have the representation has a level, which is an integer greater than 1, which corresponds to the cocycle, the 2 cocycle of the projective representation. And the representation will have a similar decomposition, this will be an irreducible representation of SU2, so it'll have a spin, which is a half integer j. And the half integer must, at any level, it has to, you only have finitely many half integers. Okay. Well, that was one thing that this, so this picture with the projections is quite important here, but there's another quite different interpretation of it, which brings in string theory almost immediately. Or at least the things that you might see in Green, Schwarz and Witten in places, the pictures that string theorists draw. And this is, so Siegel's modular functor which is sort of his version of fusion. Holomorphic. Well, let's take a picture. It's a pair of pants, but it's probably made in a foreign country, so it has some rather embarrassing bits in it. So you can't actually wear them. And anyway, it becomes a more interesting Riemann surface. Not in France, of course, because we're perfect there. So this is a Riemann surface. Couldn't really do this in Scotland, because they don't have a notion of trousers. Anyway, so here we consider the L2 space, direct some of these. This will in fact have the reverse orientation, so but don't worry about that too much. Inside here we have the projection P onto the direct sum of the Hardy spaces. That's one obvious projection, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the Riemann surface. It's just a fact we get from parameterized circles. But then, there's an obvious projection onto boundary values of holomorphic functions. On sigma. And these are a remarkable fact, which is sort of due to properties of the Cauchy integral, is that P minus Q is Hilbert-Schmidt. And therefore, in the Fock space, corresponding to the P, the tensor product of these circles, the vacuum vector corresponding to the representation Q, that was the vector, the ground state vector, will lie in here. It lies in there. It's unique up to a phase, and so if you think about that, that's equivalent to having an operator, which is Hilbert-Schmidt, between these spaces, unique up to a phase. And that is exactly what Graham's modular functor is about. In this simple case, you have an operator corresponding to a Riemann surface, and composition of operators corresponds to gluing Riemann surfaces. Okay, so that's very attractive. It's quite hard to get your hands on these things. So, and I'll explain how you can do that. But the most, we all know that you can glue together Riemann surfaces from pairs of pants, or pantalon, or trinian, or whatever. And they look like this, from above. So you have to explode them a little and look at them from above, which is a bit rude, but there you go. And so that is an important case. Now, one thing to say about pairs of pants, I've drawn them very nicely here. Uniformization theorem, which we're going to talk about at the end, says that if I take any triply connected domain like this, K can be uniformized in this way. It's very hard to do that. It's one way of doing it is just glue this to its double and use some kind of uniformization theorem of Poincaré or something like that. But to do it explicitly so you can get your hands on it is pretty tricky. And that somehow will be the goal of the very last part of the lecture. So we have to, we don't want to have just an arbitrary shape when we're going to do things, but we'll be interested in that. So it's a kind of investigation of one of the building blocks of conformal field theory. Right. So now, how can we write these operators psi sigma down a little more easily? So algebraic version of psi sigma, which is related to this kind of uniformization. Well, this will be the construction of Frenkel and Huang, and we'll use vertex operators. So if we're doing physics, we have to have fields. So here's a field. The ans are those fermions, and then the dual field and then we define, there's a Wick normal ordering. And all you need know is that have something here, which doesn't make sense. You put dots here, and it does make sense. And you move all the operators which increase the energy the other side. So that first operators that drop the energy appear first, and then, so this is a standard thing where you just, anyway. What happens now is you can define a vertex operator just take derivatives and do this kind of Wick ordering. This is a very ancient thing, so it predates even the birth of Richard Borchards, who I hope will never look at this tape. Anyway, so you define these operators where these are sort of positive integers, like this. And then what you find, if you apply this to the vacuum that was in this P and evaluate at zero, you get a vector psi. And what you've done is create a state field correspondence. This is in a canonical form. For every vector in Fock space, you have created you've worked out a quantum field which corresponds to this. And these V psi Zs form a vertex algebra. So that the axioms are due to Richard Borchards and Frenkel, Merman and Lepofsky. And then we can write out the formula quite easily. And this is really an observation of Igor Frenkel. So I'll draw a bigger picture. That's supposed to be a circle. This is supposed to be a concentric circle, and this is a wee circle here. This is Q1. This one is 1. This is Z. This is Q2. Now this is what I've done here. These things, apart from a rotation of Z, is I put down a canonical choice of something in the moduli space of these circles with two holes inside. And then the operator, psi sigma, applied to A tends to B, vectors in, this will be a vector in this space, this will be a vector in this space, is simply V Q2 to the L0 B Z Q1 to the L0 A. So this way, it's explicit, still quite hard to work with analytically, but you have an explicit way of feeding in the moduli to an equation. And you can put diffeomorphisms in here if you wish. And so that's a kind of proposed, this way makes the Siegel construction completely explicit. But you have to analyze it, of course, because it's algebraic at the moment. And really, you want to put in operators which are defined on Hilbert spaces, not just on direct sums of finite dimensional subspaces, like the finite energy vectors. Okay. Well, that's the end of that microchip, which took quite a while. But with that away, we now come on to, well, elliptic cohomology. Well, if X is a 2n dimensional oriented Riemannian manifold, it has a spin structure if the SO, the frame bundle, lifts to spin. Another way of saying that is we can form canonically the Clifford algebra bundle, and this, if you think about what this means, says that it is the endomorphisms of a vector bundle. So that's having a spin structure. Well, then, once that happens, we have a Dirac operator which acts from on this spin bundle, and then, as Atiyah and Singer did, they took the index of the Dirac, and which is an analytic invariant, and then found that it was just taking it without coefficients, the integral of the a hat genus. Right. So that's supposedly that is sort of well known as well. It's another microchip, which is slightly harder to implant. And what happens now is you replace X by the loop space of X. And you then, it actually has a diffeomorphism group acting on it, but it certainly has a rotation group. And the question is, find the analog of this for this loop space. So one is, what's the spin structure on LX? The other is, just in terms of the geometry, paths in LX. And three, the Dirac operator. Well,
it's the same Riemannian manifold.
Sorry. Yes, it's the same spin manifold, 2n dimensional. And, right. Well, the thing is, the index is sort of known, and this should be what's called the Witten genus, and it's sort of, people had found this from elliptic cohomology. They'd been inventing formal sums of characteristic classes. This goes back to Herzebruch and other people, which behaved well under cobordism and had nice multiplicative properties. And the Witten genus is one example of that. And that should be the index. And these had they were also sort of they had modular properties. And then Witten's idea of saying that there should be some Dirac operator here, which Siegel took up, was that it should be connected with conformal field theory. So this modularity should come from a CFT interpretation. Well, and we'll see why that's so. The spin structure on L of X will be interpreted directly in terms of von Neumann algebras and outer morphism groups. Oot of a 3-1 factor. The paths in L of X, this is where conformal field theory comes in, because a path in a loop space, it's a path of loops, right, which you'd normally draw like that. But in the way that things come up in this, there's no reason why the path can't do this. And so this is very natural from the point of view of elliptic cohomology in this index theorem. And so, as we know, a particular case of that are the trousers, the pair of pants, and Teichner and Stoltz, who already advocated using von Neumann algebras here, realized that work that I'd done starting with Jones was related to this, because they couldn't unfortunately have paths, full paths like this. So then they were forced to go to some infinitesimal limiting position, and there the limiting position would look like this. And they would want to understand that, and they wanted to interpret that in what I'll describe later as confusion. As a unitary kind of boundary value. And so that is the number two question. Number three question, constructing the Dirac operator is the hardest of all problems, because you need to have done the first two somehow. But help might be at hand, because one of our great hidden forces, he hides very well, Kasparov. Fortunately, he hides with you, and Kasparov and you are trying, if not to construct the Dirac operator, to construct its class in K-homology. And so at least they believe something can be done, which is so all of these problems are slightly tricky, but if enough people sort of eat away at bits of them, we get closer to getting to the goal. But anyway, the questions raised from the point of view of von Neumann algebras are very interesting. So now I'll sort of amplify on this within the framework that the mini course at the beginning. So this is a problem for Staple. Fortunately, when Adrian Ocniano is our subject, is a very sexy subject, particularly subfactors. So much so that Adrian Ocniano, whose whole life work is encased in the Ochna Cube, a giant sculpture made of rare metal in Penn State, it actually appeared in Playboy magazine, but without a staple through it. So anyway, he did not appear. You've not seen it. Uh-huh. Ask Fawn. So automorphic representations on von Neumann algebra. So von Neumann algebra, it was defined in the last lecture, so I don't have to redefine it. Well, it's the von Neumann algebra. M is the commutant or centralizer algebra of a unitary group. This definition is a good one because it tells you that they appear all over the place. You simply cannot avoid them once you've given yourself a Hilbert space. And of course, life starts in a Hilbert space. We're only seeing a very faint reflection of that in this world. Anyway, so that the commutant is written by U prime. Equally well, you could take, just using the spectral theorem, you can take a double commutant of a unitary group, and it's the same as weak operator limits of just algebraic sums like this. Weak operator limit just means in the topology given by matrix coefficients that physicists use. Well, so M is a factor. See, in this talk I've had to have X denoting a manifold because M is reserved for being a factor. If its center is just reduces to the complex numbers. And then we set Ut of M to be, we have no choice about this terminology, which is French. I've not found Ut in the French dictionary, but I'm sure it's there somewhere. It's Ut of M modulo Ant of M. So the automorphism group modulo the inners, and the inners is just the projective unitary group of M, so the unitary group of M modulo its center. Right. Then an automorphic representation is a homomorphism from G into ut of M with a Borel lift just to a map. As Alain showed, this space is horrible. It's very nice and it's also very horrible. It's horrible because often this will be dense in this. So it's an example of one of the kind of nastinesses that happen. But still, the notion of continuity would be wrong. The right notion is to have a Borel map. This is a perfectly nice space. It looks like the unit interval from its Borel structure. So
is this lifting part of the data, or you just assume?
It's part of the assumption that you don't just look at any homomorphism. This group is a locally compact group. It's a compact Lie group. And instead of putting a continuity condition in, we put a condition of measurability.
But do you have an example where you don't have such a lift?
Well, you don't know. Oh, you mean of a homomorphism from a...
Right.
It's hard enough finding examples where you do have a lift. That's...
But do you mean you have examples where you don't have a lift?
Well, if you impose no continuity, I'm sure I'd have to do a whole course in set theory. I'd even worry about what model of set theory I was using.
Yeah.
I think it's... For a compact, so for a continuous group, I don't know, even for the reals. Right. So, well, if you then...
I mean, it's about that.
Right. So I should say that these, the people who did these first, Conn and Jones, and it goes back, the algebraic structure can already be found in MacLane. And it's called the theory of G-kernels. And probably even Teichmuller. Teichmuller did something with Galois representations in Deutsche Mathematik. So, since it's just a homomorphism modulo inners, you'll be able to write something down like this, where this is a unitary, so again a Borel function, and then associativity implies that you'll have, if you just write down alpha x, alpha y, alpha z is alpha x, alpha y, alpha z, just write that out, then you will obtain this relation. Okay, and then this omega will be a Borel function, and it will be a Borel cohomology class for G in the sense of Calvin-Moore. So it's Calvin-Moore Borel cohomology, and we know because of Graham Segal and then afterwards David Figner that this is the same as H4 of BG with coefficients in Z. So BG is a classifying space, this is just singular cohomology. And if G is simple and simply connected, this is just Z. So there is something there. Okay, and now this invariant is called the Conn-Jones invariant because Alain, in his classification of the easy part of the classification, in fact, of automorphisms of the 2-1 factor, found this construction, found this obstruction, and then Jones, in his thesis, so Alain did it for finite cyclic groups, and Vaughan Jones then generalized that to finite groups. So this is the Conn-Jones invariant. Right, so I'm going to slightly cut. There are two, so the two ways of constructing this. A, well, it's not the one I'm going to show you, is by ergodic theory. This was found afterwards, and essentially you take infinitely many copies of G, you take Bernoulli shift, and you perturb left multiplication by G by a Singer co-cycle. So the Singer, not the washing machine Singer, it's the famous Singer of a Tier and Singer, who in his youth started out working in operator algebras and actually did some very useful things there. And this is one of them. So this is a canonical construction that will work. But since this isn't, today at least, a conference in ergodic theory, I will suppress this. This is somehow a universal construction. It was not the first to be discovered. So the second one is by loop groups. And this was sort of motivated by the Teichner-Stoltz questions. And what we do here, so this is just thought experiment country. We draw a picture first. Here's the picture. It's my circle, which has been cut in two. And then we have an upper interval and a lower interval. And then we can invent two subgroups of the loop group. Normal subgroups. And this is loops which are one in the complement. And these are loops which are one in I.
Loops are continuous.
Well, they were exactly the kind of loops I was talking about before. They're continuous and piecewise differential derivatives, which you'll see you need for the things I'm going to say next. So here, I take the loop group and I can evaluate it at plus or minus one. So I get two elements of the group just by evaluating the loops there. And here, the kernel of this homomorphism is loops equal to 1 at plus or minus 1. But by exactly the conditions of continuous and piecewise continuous derivative, this is equal to the product of simply because if you've got a loop which vanishes at 1 and minus 1, first of all, you can redefine it to be 1 on the upper circle, and then you get something in here. Redefine it to be 1 on the lower circle, and you get something in here. And then the product is obviously what you first thought of. Okay, well, this idea of breaking the circle up comes from Rudolf Haag. It is the idea of algebraic quantum field theory, which before I might have unkindly defined as a theory without examples, apart from the free field theory, which is still true in 3 plus 1 dimensions, but that's almost true of all of physics in some sense. But here in low dimensions, everything he predicted works very nicely, which is kind of cool. And in particular, for this, if we have a positive energy representation, then we find that these two groups commute. And that tells us that if we look at the map, by conjugation on, well, now I'll take this, take its double commutant. So G acts by conjugation on this normal subgroup, and so will act on the von Neumann algebra it generates. Now, what I'm going to check, first of all, obviously Li of G acts by inners. So if I look at the map Lg into out of N, this is contained in the kernel of that map. And equally well, because of this locality, this is also contained in the kernel of the map because it commutes with everything. So this actually factors through G cross G. This is in the kernel. So I get a map from G cross G into out of N. The diagonal action, the elements G cross G, diagonal G cross G correspond to constant loops, so that's not very interesting. And if I then take G cross 1 going into here, I'll get a map from G into out of M, or out of M, sorry, and, okay, that is going to be this construction of a homomorphism from G into out of M, and I have to have an integer attached to it, the Kohn-Jones invariant. The integer is just the level. So that's it. So this is something that sort of, I guess everybody in operator algebras knew it was around. Teichler and Stoltz had got a sort of weak version of it just with Clifford algebras, and then by them asking a question, this sort of came out. It's a very kind of natural construction. It's slightly unexpected all the same. But as I say, once you've seen this ergodic theory construction, which I have to say is really due to Alain, you had exactly that construction yourself in hidden away paper at that period. We check every time that something hasn't already been done in our subject, and it's a not normal place to look. Okay. Well, what happens with this now, and how Teichler and Stoltz use this, I'll just be very brief. We have this extension, which is horrible. We have the compact group going into this, and in this case I'll take SO2N. Then, spin 2N. Here, I pull back the sequence. And I get an extension of spin 2N by the projective unitary group M. Now, although this is horrible, because this is compact and actually has a locally continuous lift, this is perfectly nice. It's a Polish group. That does not mean it will do your plumbing for you. Alas. At least not in France. Anyway, so it's complete metric group and everything, and so everything is hunky-dory. The condition L of X has a spin structure if and only if the spin 2n bundle over X lifts the string. So it's putting von Neumann algebras right there at the start with these bundles, which this hasn't been completely worked out, all the ramifications. Here, if I just put any group, I get a principal bundle over G with structure group PUM. And that is if you substitute for PUM, PU of the larger Hilbert space, this is a Dixmier duodi. It's a continuous trace algebra central extension, which is, because of the way it's constructed, it's equivariant for conjugation. So this sort of contains many, many things. Right. The last thing. So that's somehow. And by the way, so of course, Volland and Alain proved that this Kohn-Jones invariant was a complete invariant, and that requires a certain stability condition on the representations. Here, the same result is true. This is a complete invariant. It's easier in the 2-1 case, which is that ergodic theory construction. And again, that uses the very hard technology that Sorin Popper invented. So Sorin kind of simplified some of Alain's classification proofs by embedding them in Vaughan Jones's theory of subfactors and the theory of amenable subfactors. And again, that can be used to prove this classification for compact groups because their duals are amenable. So really, you reduce everything to a dual thing. Anyway, that's sort of contained in the language which I'm now going to introduce, because we're going to sort of stray a little into the land of subfactors, but not very far. That will be the last time I say subfactor, for example. So a geometric interpretation of confusion. So this is, confusion is a tensor product which we write as a square for bimodules over von Neumann algebras. And both Alain and principally Vaughan, for the special class of bimodules that we'll now see, show that this is a very, very rich area. And what happens is we'll take positive energy representations, x, y, of the loop group of SU2, and we'll take them irreducible. And what we do is, it's easier to do this in this case, because instead of talking about von Neumann algebras, we can talk about subgroups. We split the circle up and regard them as modules for this. Or, and because I can sort of think of both sides of the circle as being roughly the same, as bimodules. And then the fusion, just to show you that there is a definition which is not the obvious one, is obtained by introducing replacing states by operators. Here this is the vacuum representation of loops on SU2, so its lowest energy space is trivial. And y hom and then the fused module is just this tensor product, but we kind of quotient out by introducing a funny inner product. Not funny to a physicist, because they would know and love this. It's called a four-point function. And then we complete, and that's the definition of the fusion. And it's also a module over this. And you compute it. Well, it's when you compute it, here are the rules, and this is the kind of subfactor theory. You get this is H half, that's the two-dimensional representation at the bottom. The usual rules for tensoring with SU2. This microchip, I assume, is in everybody's head, and then the end representation. It has only one place to go, and I don't have enough space to write anything else anyway. Right. So that's how that fusion comes. And this is the fusion for loop group SU2. People have done this also with quantum SU2, but here it's sort of more natural, because you do the definition, it's there. Right,
your
so that...
G is SU2
here. But this would work for any group in this example. Right, so now people have for a long time suggested that what's happening is that two circles are being glued together in the middle to identify the subgroups, and then the outer one is appearing like that. So this suggestive picture was taken as a fact by Teichner and Stoltz, and there was some attempt to make this rigorous, actually doing the fusion geometrically. So the trouble is, if you take something like this with sharp corners and take the Hardy space projection, then nastiness appears from the corners, because this is not even compact, unless the function vanishes very much at the endpoints.
You mean this is VMO, is this?
Yes, so there's a nastiness that appears here. So all sorts of things break down. It's not impossible by very, very careful thought that you can get around that. So what I've been thinking about with Vaughan is another way around this. And this is, Vaughan has had some idea that bimodules and fusion appear everywhere in physics, so we just have to look for them. And this is one example where it's sort of happening, and where, again, with what Alain is saying, a type 1 situation approaches a type 3 situation. And you want to understand one in terms of the other. And here, the idea is that you would take the Siegel fusion things, which are norm 1 Hilbert-Schmidt operators, and as the circles explode, these, in the limit, should approach something that can be identified in this formalism as vectors or operators. Now, everything is kind of the same. The X's and Y's that appear here, these are just compressed fermions. So all of the operators that appear here are not very far from what appears in this kind of Siegel picture. So let me end by saying I'm just going to draw some pictures, if you'll allow me, Paul. I'm not sure that you can put them on your computer, or whether you're even allowed to put them on your computer. Assuming you're not playing a video game. Right. So, in order to solve this problem, one has to understand what goes on here in some concrete way. And so, first of all, we have our split circle, which we map here in an obvious way by sending one of these points to infinity. And then we draw four points here. This is e to the I pi over 4. The others are circled round in the obvious way. And then we invent a quadratic differential, which will give us the circle. So this quadratic differential, just phi, is equal to 4 z squared 1 plus z squared squared dz squared. This is a quadratic differential, and then we get a change of coordinates, which is just given by integrating the square root of phi. And when we do that, the horizontal lines in this coordinate give the exploding circles, and the vertical lines allow us to time track the explosion. So we can follow a point. This is kind of two foliations, which are orthogonal. So that's the first thing. Then, just to end, we have these circles in some kind of canonical form. We use this coordinate, and what it gives us everything becomes straight lines. So and W so we're kind of maximizing the symmetry to be able to do the uniformization. And now what we want to move this to, this is kind of, I haven't drawn this properly, this is kind of the wiggly horrible thing that we have, that we want to uniformize. And now here, we would like to have this, where everything are nice semicircles, and the same lettering as here. And if we look at that, we'll kind of just take a little segment of it for fun. We got a 45 degree thing here, A, F, E, D. Right, so that's the problem we have in mind. Now, we remember there was a great mathematician, because I'm curious, Felix Klein, who in the 1890s said you should uniformize using eigenvalues of Sturm-Liouville operators. It should be converted to a second-order problem. We would now say, oh, well, that's all contained in the Lie algebra of the diffeomorphism group. It's obvious. And, in fact, in this case, so following the method of Schwarz, and here, to get information of this, look, a very good friend of mine has written a Wikipedia article on the Riccati equation, which explains this in painful detail, how you uniformize. You look at this differential equation up here. You take 3/16, you have these half periods, So you have a Weierstrass P function. You look for the lowest eigenvalues, the natural boundary conditions. And, right, so you have this equation, which you look at the asymptotics of it, because the degeneration is when these things sort of shrink, become very, very thin. That's what the explosion does. And then the uniformization is simply done by taking two solutions and taking their quotient. That's it. So, in the end, the problem of checking whether Seidel fusion, like this, tends towards confusion, is reduced to the spectral properties of an ODE in the complex domain. You have to look at it on all four sides or it behaves differently, and then put the asymptotics together. And in the process, I've done two of the sides, I'm now doing two of the other sides, and just crossing my fingers. It should be true. Something should be true. Okay, so that's it.